Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com. I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
Today, we are going to spend some time talking about chef documentaries. Jimmy, we're kind of in a golden age of movies, television shows, straight-to-video documentaries. If you want to know about chefs and how they do what they do and where they come, I mean, there's basically no element of a chef's life that you cannot get on your laptop.
Yeah, look up on Netflix.
Yeah, and spend hours experiencing. Two recent ones, we spent a very few minutes last week spontaneously talking about King George, which is Erica Frankel's documentary about George Perrier of Lebec Fenn, the late Lebec Fenn in Philadelphia. And then just recently on video on demand and just in the last week on Netflix, For Grace, which is Kevin Pang and Mark Helanowski's film about Curtis Duffy and the genesis of his three-star Michelin restaurant Grace in Chicago, came up online in a big way. And we both have just watched that in the last week. We're going to spend most of this show today talking about those two movies, one of which documents the end of a restaurant and one of which documents the beginnings of a restaurant, but both of which we feel like really have much in common and say a lot about, you know, what I would broadly call our industry, but really, Jimmy, your industry and what you guys like you do for a living. But before we do that, we're going to do something a little different here. We're thrilled to have an old friend of both of ours, Andrea Strong, who's a food writer based in New York City. Andrea's written for The New York Times, Architectural Digest, Syriot's Eats, Edible Manhattan. It goes on and on. Also, for years, has had her own blog, The Strong Buzz, yeah, which we were talking before the show, Andrea. You were really sort of the first high-profile food blogger.
Yeah, I am a dinosaur. I am a blogging dinosaur.
But The Strong Buzz started when?
Yeah, it started in 2003 as sort of a way to get my work out there and all of the freelancing that I was doing and the news that I had just from eating out all the time and hanging out with Jimmy.
Right.
And it just sort of blossomed and really became something. I had no idea that people actually wanted to hear what I had to say about where I was eating, but apparently they did.
Right.
So went on for 10 years.
And that predated, I mean, you predated Grub Street and, yeah, and a lot of the other sites.
I look at it, she's the, Andrea's the OG, you know. So not, I wouldn't say dinosaur, I'd say the OG, the OG of the New York food blog.
So it was an interesting sort of dovetailing of circumstances. A number of friends had said to me and Jimmy, you know, love the show. You know, people who don't know you guys maybe don't know who the hell you are, you know, and here you are. I don't know how many people even necessarily without piecing it together realize that I, Andrew, am a writer. And you, Jimmy, are a chef owner, operator.
Right.
And around the time that we were starting to get this feedback, Andrea approached us and said that she wanted to interview us for one of the places where she writes, which is the Open for Business blog, which is Open Tables blog. And we said, well, why don't you come on the show? We'll spend the first few minutes of the show and let's just do the interview on the air. So we're going to turn it over to you, and our listeners maybe will get to know us a little bit better, and then we'll move into our whole documentary fest.
Well, I've known Andrew and Jimmy a long time, probably 10 years, maybe more, 20 years.
Yeah, much more than
10. 20 years.
Much more than 10.
But I actually don't know a lot about how each of you got to the places that you are right now in this beautiful room off of Roberta's. So, Andrew, I'm going to start with you. You went to Columbia. You're an English major, and you were producing TV and film, and then you were an editor for a tennis magazine. So tell me, how did all of that land you writing cookbooks with Alfred Portale and Lauren Torrendell?
So I was an assistant to a film producer, trying to be a screenwriter. Tennis writing came a little bit later. And the screenwriting thing, for me, I got, it's a very common story, excruciatingly close to something happening and nothing happening. And, to make a very long story as short as I can, I, got out of the film business because I had very little time to write, actually, because it was such a demanding job. And, I didn't know what else to do for a living, you know, and I got a job. I just thought, what do out-of-work writers do? And this was before Ken Cosgrove's useful example on Mad Men. but I got a job with a PR firm. I thought, well, you know, I'll write press releases. That's what you do as an out-of-work writer. And I happened to go work for one of the top food PR companies in New York. It was a company called Kratz & Company, where a lot of people who now own their own agencies started. And one of my clients was Alfred Portale and of the Gotham Barn Grill. And, you know, if he and other clients had a speech to give or a difficult letter to write or an article that they needed ghosted, I just started doing that for them. And then, you know, in what I thought would be a one-time lark, Alfred asked me to write the Gotham Barn Grill cookbook for him. That was the first thing I ever got paid a nickel to write, was that cookbook.
Wow. So did you leave the firm and do that on your own, or you did it as part of being...
The deal I had with David was that my boss at the time was, no problem, great, I don't want to see it in the office. So I wrote, and the book, it's a longer story. There was an author before me that didn't quite work out, and a co-author before me. And so it was a nights and weekends proposition. It was a lot of sort of work all day at the firm, take off my jacket and tie, stay in the office and like write. Sometimes, I mean, I was in my 20s. Sometimes I'd write overnight, run across the street to Equinox, take a shower, and come back to work. Yeah. So anyway, that's how I got started in that. And then saw an opportunity, never wanted to be a food writer, saw an opportunity through the success of that book to maybe parlay it into something, and left my job and started, you know, looking for projects. And that was 20-some, mostly collaborations ago. And then I did my own nonfiction book in 2009 called Knives at Dawn, about the Bocuse d'Or cooking competition. And currently writing my second nonfiction book, which is a history of the American chefs of the 70s and 80s, which Dan Halpern's Echo is going to publish next year.
Wow.
So that's the thumbnail.
And now let's just check in with Jimmy. Jimmy, you have had the Red Cat for almost 20
years.
We're
going to be 17 in about a month.
And you've mentored some of the most beloved chefs in our industry, Harold Dieterle, Joey Campanaro, Amanda Freitag, Aaron Sanchez,
Mikey Price.
But you grew up in Rhode Island eating like kind of strange lunch foods. I just wrote a story that you were in about the strange lunches that your mother would pack for you. Ezekiel's bread with like sprouts and peanut butter and
it was my stepmother.
Stepmother.
I had a dual life, you know, living with my father was one way and it was a little more hippie and a little more freewheeling. And then living with my mother lived in Philadelphia. My father lived in Rhode Island and I lived in both all the time. I never really lived in one place in my life more than 18 months until I moved to New York. She was organic peanut butter sprinkled with powdered milk in between Ezekiel bread slices.
Yeah, that'll put you in the kitchen to figure out how to make something better.
With the carob bar.
Naturally.
Yes,
Tiger's milk bar, one of those 70s.
Yeah, this is a long time ago.
So I read that you actually got a scholarship to CIA and you turned it down to just kind of drive around the country and cook and get your culinary education that way. Is that correct?
Well, it's mostly correct. And we touched on it with the George Perrier piece. I worked in a restaurant in Philadelphia that's no longer there. It was next door to Beck Finn, and it was the one of the top five, you know, nicest restaurants in Philadelphia. It was the nicest Italian restaurant. And we did a dinner, Beck Finn in this restaurant, and we raised like $40,000 for this thing called The Book and the Cook.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Back in the day, Craig Claiborne was a pioneer of that. And So I was the only cook in both kitchens that never went to culinary school. So I said, hey, can I get this scholarship, one of these scholarships? And my boss said, yes, yeah, sure. And Chef Perrier said, yes, yeah, sure. And I did all the work, and I got accepted to the CIA, and I was supposed to start in November. And the school called me in August and said this, that, and the other thing, and we want you to pay for the first semester. I said, you guys have 20 grand in your bank account paid up front. Like, that's mm-hmm. not fair. So I went to work, and I talked to my boss, and he said, I can't help you with that. You know, and he was a CIA alum, and the guy who owned the restaurant was a CIA alum. And so I was really, really disappointed and disenchanted, and it was one of those times in my life where I just felt like, if you're not going to help me, I'm right. just going to give up. You know, my deal with them was I'll go to school and I'll come back and I'll work here for 2 years. So that's a 4 or 5 year plan mm-hmm. of not making any money.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of sacrifice, but those are the sacrifices I wanted to make and I was willing to make. And I was devastated, you know, about the school thing. But really, I just woke up one day and I was like, I don't feel supported by anybody. And the school's already got the money and no one's championing me in any way. Mm-hmm. So I went to work and I had a simple conversation with the boss and the owner, and they were like, yeah, I'm sorry, we can't help you. And I said, listen, I quit. And I got up and quit, and I moved to Vail, Colorado. And, you know, within 3 years, I was, you know, a leader of a kitchen. Mm-hmm. So it was really, it was a great experience in the end, but right. it was, you know, one of
Sounds
my worst.
Kind of painful.
Yeah, I was totally heartbroken. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't like 18 years old right out of high school, but I was maybe, you know, 20, 21 years old at that time.
Yeah. And then what brought you back to New York?
That's a great one. I was the chef of this restaurant, and these customers approached me, and they said, hey, we really want you to be the chef of our new restaurant we're building out in Colorado. I said, great. So they hired me. I moved out to Colorado. The restaurant was in a hotel. I lived in the hotel. Mm-hmm. 4 months went by, and they came to me, and they said, listen, it's never going to happen. We can't get the permitting. It's never going to happen. You're fired.
And I said, okay.
I just moved my whole life out here, quit my job,
Thank
la, la, la.
You.
I said, how about giving me a little walk away money? And they were like, yeah, sure. That's no problem. So they gave me, you know, not a lot, but not a little, you know, maybe 10, 20 grand or something like that, which to me was a year's salary.
Right.
And I didn't know where to live. I didn't have anywhere to live. I was living in a hotel room for 4 months, and I was living in Martha's Vineyard before that. And when I was living in Martha's Vineyard, I would travel in the winters. So I really never had a home. I called a friend and I said, you know, this is my story. We were just talking and she said, hey, there's a furnished sublet I can get you in New York. Come 3 months. So I was like, that's great. 3 months will give me some time to clear my head and mm-hmm. figure out what's next. I arrived on a Monday in, you know, I believe January 94. And within 2 weeks, I was offered an executive chef position, and the woman upstairs from where I was living passed, and the landlord offered me the apartment.
Wow.
So it was really like, holy hell, this is a hard town. This is a tough town. People are talking to me. I don't even understand what they're saying, but like, I got a job and I got an apartment.
And someone died and I have a place to
and
live.
And I didn't look for either. Like, this has got to mean something. So I really wrapped my head around that kind of, you know, I don't know if it's zeitgeist or if it just felt
it's in the stars.
It was kind of like my first cooking job, serious cooking job. I was like, I feel good. I get this. I feel calm. I'm not thinking the way I was thinking. And I was cooking to pay for school. And
right.
then I was like, what? This, I feel great doing this. I feel comfortable. I feel confident. This feels natural. And that was a little bit of how New York felt when I moved here. So I just, you know.
And where was the restaurant? What was the restaurant you worked at? The first one?
It was on 17th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue. And it was like this, you know, back in the day in New York, it was you go to dinner, then you go to a nightclub. And
right.
now there's lounges and bars mm-hmm. with couches and not a lot of nightclubs and not a lot of dance places. But this was one of those first ever, you know, early 90s. You don't need to leave here to go to a dance club. We can, you know, figure out a party to have here all night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that kind of place and those kind of customers. It was really a great learning experience for me. It wasn't a great job, but it was a great learning experience. And I didn't have the job for very long, maybe a year or so. And
mm-hmm.
I was let go. But
and then you work with Jonathan Waxman, and is that right?
Yeah. We have a long history that's, you know, a little too much for this interview, but I ended up working for him and opening Bryant Park Grill when
right,
he moved
right.
back to Manhattan.
And then the Red Cat in 1999.
Yeah, I moved here in 94, opened the Red Cat in 99.
So given that the Red Cat has been around so long, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you make a restaurant something so evergreen or so popular for so long. I mean, the calf's liver, rather.
Ah, yes.
The string beans, the hospitality, the consistency. And it's, you know, there's a lot going on culinarily in New York City.
Yeah.
So why are people still eating at Red Cat? And how did you manage to figure out the formula?
I don't know if it was a formula more so than a thought. You know, like at the Red Cat, it's a little bit of the aim was true, you know, in the sense that it's all I ever wanted. You know, I wanted a non-affected or non-precious place, you know, maybe you'd call it a neighborhood place. You know, it under-promises and over-delivers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And and the other thought was, you know, I want to have my own business and I want to have it by the time I'm 30 and I want it to last forever. And I never want to change it. You know, I don't want to go 10 years and reconceptualize it. I don't want to do these things and that you see other restaurateurs do for one reason or another. I wanted it to be the way it was from the moment it was born. And it turns out that it was an idea that people were ready for in New York at the time and still now.
Yeah,
so
still are.
You know, restaurants are about how you're made to feel. You know, it's not just this one thing about the food or, you know, it's really an all-encompassing package, and it's how you're made to feel, which is, you know, somewhat of the definition of hospitality in a sense. And you just got behind the there's no reason why waiters in New York should be surly. There's no reason why waiters should tell you how to eat, you know. I mean, people should make suggestions, but as a guest, you should get what you want, and you should be made to feel comfortable. So, like, when we opened, everybody wanted to talk about comfort food. I was like, I think you're missing it.
Right.
You know, comfort food is meatloaf and mashed potatoes. People want comfort food. They go to an Irish diner, you know. They go to a bar, you know. Like, this isn't comfort food, but people feel comfortable, so you can call it whatever you want. As long as we stay in business forever, I'm fine with that type label.
Right. So you and Andrew met through the cookbook or before that?
No, we
over
met.
Over beers?
No, I used to live on the block. Well, I lived in the neighborhood first and then on the block. I moved to a different apartment, but I lived right a stone's throw from Red Cat.
Lucky you.
When Red Cat opened, and you know, that restaurant, although there were certainly others around, but Way West Chelsea, which is where it's located, was sort of a restaurant wasteland.
Yeah.
And so early in the day, my now wife and I, we were just dating at the time, but we used to go in at least once a week because it was there. We went in a lot for Sunday dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to get very friendly with Jimmy and with Jimmy's ex-business partner, Danny Abrams. As most of the books I've done have grown out of my social life. I mean, the truth, that's just the way it happens to work out. And Jimmy and I just started talking about, so I met you in 99.
Yeah.
And then we did the book 5-6 years later.
Yeah, I think it was maybe 2004, came out in 2006.
Yeah.
And from the second I met Andrew, I just thought, you know, well, besides totally digging him and his wife and having fun talking with him and, you know, experiencing life with him, I thought if I ever have an opportunity to do a cookbook, this is the dude that I'm doing it with. You know, there was no thought or question. It's like I really enjoy this man's company, and I think he's a cool cat, and he's very smart, and you know, if the cards are there, that's what I really want to do.
Yeah. And at the time I lived on the block where the Red Cat was, and once every other Wednesday night we would test recipes, and at the time Jimmy still had the Harrison restaurant, which closed a couple years ago, and he said to me, I got this young, was he a sous chef?
Harold?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I got this young sous chef. I think I'm going to bring him in to help us test recipes. And that was a young, unknown Harold Dieterle.
Yeah.
And the three of us would get in the prep kitchen at the Red Cat every other Wednesday night.
That's awesome.
And test recipes. And then usually I'd go home with a like a parfait glass with whatever sundae they were serving, and I'd walk home with the glass and bring it back the next day. That was my like post-testing treat.
That's hilarious.
I remember walking by like the Half King bar, and you know,
with your ice cream sundae,
with my ice cream sundae, and draw, you know, everybody at the Half King looking at me like I was some kind of lunatic. yeah, that was our history.
So you've known each other a long time, and what were you at a bar doing shots of Maker's Mark or something when you decided you wanted a radio show? How did this come about? What was the impetus
for
the
quick story on the show was we had both separately guested on a couple of shows here on Heritage.
Yeah.
Michael Lameco's show. I had also done Michael Harlan Turkell's show, The Food Scene. And I guess the feeling was between Jack Inslee and who's looking at me through the glass and Aaron Fairbanks. And Jimmy got the same feedback. Hey, you know, you guys, you're pretty good on the air. You should pitch us a show. We actually had an idea for a show.
Oh, Shift Drink.
Shift Drink. We wanted to do a show called Shift Drink where we were going to go out in the field and go drinking with different chefs each week, kind of like Vice Munchies is a little bit.
Or Chef Drunk History.
Right. We were going to go out and do that in the field, and it just...
That sounds good.
Yes, but it was more of a technological burden than we could bear. So we loved the idea. We just knew we weren't going to be able to do it. And then this show... It just kind of organically came up. I don't even know how we just kept, I don't know, it was this thing in the background like, yeah, it'd be fun to do something. We'd like to do something together.
Right. When you have a collaborator and, you know, it's really a magical thing. And I had such a great experience with the cookbook. I was, you know, always thinking, I just want to do more with Andrew whenever the opportunity comes up, like the cookbook, you know. Not just calling every day, what are we going to do, what are we going to do, but, you know, through conversations over the years, like, let's just do something again together. And, you know, Andrew told you a little bit more about the process of how we came here and do this. But, you know, for me, it's just like I really enjoy collaborating with Andrew on, you know, I guess so far books and radio. I don't know what it'll be next, but hopefully we'll be doing it.
Documentary
for,
film.
Yeah, documentary. Right. Or a buddy comedy. Buddy
romance.
Movie. We'll be handcuffed for 90 minutes
of the
buddy
movie. I see you in the next Hangover.
Yeah, we'll get something on Netflix soon.
But, you know, I think one of the things about the show that we thought when we started talking about it is, because I don't think it's that usual to have a chef and a writer paired up. You know, it is to have a writer kind of ghostwriter collaborate with the chef. That's very normal.
Right.
But we like the idea of a show where some weeks, you know, we would have chefs and writers together, and some weeks we would just have chefs. And then what we're doing today, which was very deliberate, it's not that we couldn't book other guests today, but in the spirit of kind of this conversation we're having with you, you know, it was always part of our thought. And we just, you know, when the show started, there were a lot of, this is our ninth episode. You know, there were a lot of big stories at the beginning of the year. You know, Kat Kinsman launched her Chefs with Issues program. And then tragically, there was Chef Viollet's suicide. There was the Chris Schoenberger and Justin Beloit's piece in First We Feast. And there were these things that felt very much like what we wanted to talk about, which was, or what we wanted the show to be, which was a place that we booked and planned in real time each week to talk about what was going on that week. Mm-hmm. Not every week presents a big story. And then we've started doing like what we did a few weeks ago with Gabe McMackin and Justin Smiley, which was what, you know, an all shop talk episode, which actually for us was one of our favorite shows. You know, we love like the old show Car Talk.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons we wanted to do it, the show ourselves today. You know, there's a show called The Tennis Podcast that I'm in love with. Right. It's always the same two hosts. Stuff You Missed in History Class. There's a show I love called Film Spotting. These shows are mostly just the two hosts, which is not what we're going to do always, but it's something we always thought was something we wanted to do sometimes. So that's what we're going to do when we, you know, wrap up with this portion of the show. But that, you know, it just seemed to us that it might give people, you know, as somebody who started off very much as an outsider and now to some extent I feel, you know, like as much a part of the cooking trade as one can be without actually doing it, you know, I take for granted now the stuff that I'm privy to see and hear about the industry. And we just thought like a place where people could talk the way Jimmy and I might talk, or Jimmy and I and the other guests who've been in the room might talk if we all found ourselves out for a drink, you know, at 11 o'clock one night. That was sort of the idea of the show. I mean, it was really that simple.
Right.
And that's what it is.
Yeah, I think it's been great. I mean,
thank you.
It's getting a lot of buzz in the industry, and I think having the perspective of a writer who's been in the business for as long as you have and a chef who's been in the business, we've all been around a long time. It's nice to have that energy, and it fills a real gap in the conversation about the industry that has not been here today.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, I guess that would be the other thing for us is that, you know, so much of what gets communicated these days is communicated in very small bites, you know, no pun intended. But, you know, you get... I mean, you know, it's not that unusual to say to someone, oh, did you hear about this? Oh, yeah, I saw it on my Twitter feed. But, you know, they didn't click through and actually read the article. If they did read the article, it might be some very hurriedly written three-paragraph thing. It's very common to hear chefs talk about, you know, giving 90 minutes or an hour of time to a journalist, and then a piece gets written that's
this is my biggest pet peeve.
You know, but a piece gets written that's, like, really small for whatever reason. And so, again, you know, for us and any chefs who are listening, please, you know, keep this in mind. You know, our dream... Well, David Kinch came on our third episode. He had just opened his new place, The Bywater, 2 days before he was on. That's, like, a dream
that's
for
awesome.
Us. You know, or people who have news that's breaking and want a place where they can come on and actually have a conversation about it beyond, you know, the sentence from them that's in their press release.
Right,
or
it's not going to be edited down to 140 characters.
Or edited or taken out of context.
Yeah.
So, you know, we kind of, you know, without wanting to kind of kiss people's butts when they're here, we did want it to be, you know, again, we thought a chef and a writer together would sort of give people this sense of sort of a trusted place to come and talk about things.
It's like a culinary living room. It's very comfortable
Thank
here.
You,
I recommend that you come,
Thank
whoever you.
You
are.
Thank you.
We got to use that line.
Well, with that, we're going to shift gears.
Yeah.
And Andrea, feel free to jump in. I know you haven't seen these movies, but...
I haven't.
So again, we're going to have a conversation about these two chef documentaries, King George, which again is Erica Frankel's documentary about George Perrier in the last days of Lebec Fenn. And For Grace, which is Kevin Pang and Mark Helanowski's film about Chef Curtis Duffy in Chicago and the birth of his restaurant, Grace. And as we were saying, Jimmy, I mean, there is such a wealth of filmmaking like this right now. There's our friend Mike Colomeco, who's also has a show here on Heritage. His show Real Food has been around for a long time. There's Mind of a Chef. Chef's Table just got renewed for 3 seasons with an amazing list of chefs that they're going to profile. There was Paul Liebrandt's Matter of Taste. And I guess what maybe, you know, we talked briefly last week about the George Perrier film, but I think what maybe would be a good place to start, and then we'll take a break and get into all this in more detail. I think what's maybe useful about these films is, you know, what do you get from each thing that distinguishes it, right? So for me, For Grace, the film about Curtis Duffy, you know, I was watching it, and I should say these are both available on video on demand, and For Grace about a week ago became available on Netflix. You know, I was watching it and I thought, gosh, you know, this is very familiar to me having seen the Paul Liebrandt film, A Matter of Taste. You know, it starts off, he's at a restaurant, Curtis is, where he's not very happy. You know, Matter of Taste began with Paul at Papillon.
Mm-hmm.
And they start talking about this new project that he has in mind. But then the film, and if people have read... Kevin Pang actually wrote a very long article that kind of traces the narrative of the film, basically, for the Tribune a couple of years ago. But the, you know, you get this really horrific sort of backstory that Curtis has, you know, family tragedy that involved a murder-suicide. And I think what very much comes through and what I would say distinguishes this film in a way that I don't feel like I've seen it in other movies is this notion of the kitchen as a surrogate family, of the kitchen as a sanctuary,
right.
Which I think is something that all cooks relate to, or most cooks. How do you agree with that?
A band of like-minded misfits.
Right, but writ large. I mean, his backstory is so horrible.
Yeah. But, you know, through adversity, there's oftentimes triumph, you know, Phoenix rising from the ashes. And there's a lot of that in the culinary field. What drove you to get into it? You know, was it this or that? And when we were getting into it, it certainly wasn't, oh, mom and dad said I should do that. You know, it was just the opposite.
Right.
So, you know, you hear a good amount of stories of people having incredible life challenges, you know, whether they're family or personal or all the above. And they find something that makes them feel calm, and they find their serenity, and they find a voice or a way. And, you know, I found it in a room that's called a kitchen, and a lot of other people did as well subsequently that we see. You know, one of the great things about this interest in the business is we get to talk about it more, and not just, you know, those guys in the back that are, you know, fat and drunk and, you know, misfits. Yeah, maybe we are, maybe we're not, but, you know, there's two sides, or there's more sides to the story, any story, than just the one side that's being said at the moment, you know. So it's a great opportunity for people to really see what it's like and what it takes to achieve, you know, success at whatever level you want in the restaurant business or in a professional kitchen.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that when we come back. Maybe something these two films very much have in common is two people who really give their lives.
Leave it all on the field.
And give it all on the field. Give it all to the field.
And, you know, one is maybe a little bit more about ending, and one is maybe a little bit more about beginning. And, you know, there's a lot to learn from, you know, both sides of entering into a business. You know, nothing lasts forever, you know, so.
Agreed. So we're chatting here with Andrea Strong, and we're talking about the documentaries For Grace and King George, and we're going to pick up on both those films when The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew returns after this break.
Program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We're talking about chef documentaries, specifically two that debuted recently on video on demand. King George, about Chef George Perrier in Philadelphia, and For Grace, about Curtis Duffy of Grace Restaurant in Chicago. By the way, Jimmy, did you notice the incredible utility of the word grace for headlines, for articles, for metaphors,
for tattoos.
it's a name that really lends itself to talking about and depicting that restaurant and that story. You know, we were talking a minute ago about kitchens as sort of sanctuaries, as places that conjure up surrogate families. I think both these films really give a sense of that. You know, we spoke last week briefly about in King George, this moment where you realize that George Perrier is spending his birthday working in the restaurant. If anyone didn't hear that, it's in the first 5 minutes of episode 8 of our show. In this movie, there is, first of all, you know, kitchen can be a lot of different things. And what's so amazing to me, and I think you'd agree with this, Jimmy, the relationship in this movie, which begins, and they actually have a shot of it, with Curtis Duffy as a little boy taking a home ec class, which he feels like is a thing that girls do. He doesn't want to learn how to sew, and, you know, it really kind of...
Rather skateboard.
Yes, it really offends his sort of, prepubescent sense of masculinity, right? And they have a shot of the kitchen classroom. It's the most adorable little classroom.
Susie Homemaker.
And there's this woman, and we meet her in the film several times, named Ruth Snyder, who was his teacher, and it's an amazing relationship. And she really, usually when you think about the kitchen saving someone, you think about someone going into a kitchen as a teenager, professionally, and getting their first job. This was someone who had a family tragedy and connects with this home ec teacher in a way that profoundly changed his life, and it's a relationship he still has to this day. And this, to me, was something completely unique.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. I've never, first of all, just that relationship is unique, but then to also, you know, have this document of it, this video document of speaking to her, speaking to him, seeing the classroom, seeing her visit the restaurant.
Yeah, it's a real privilege to see it unwind. You know, to me, one of the interesting things is the longevity, you know, and in this instant society, and also, you know, with people, you move, you know, things happen, whatever happens. And they stumbled into this relationship together, and it just continues to grow and bloom and blossom, and you know, they both are really fulfilled by it many, many, many years later. And you know, that's a real life success story, you know.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting to me, and maybe we should take a moment on it, you know, there's a lot that's been the whole issue of women in the kitchen has been very much in the news. I think it really, that Time magazine piece a few years ago, you know, lit a fuse that hasn't quite, you know, burned itself out yet. It comes up a lot. We talked about it here recently. We're doing a whole show about it in 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
But, you know, it's really interesting to me, this character of Ruth Snyder really exists in opposition to almost any sort of chef mentor figure you've ever seen. You know, there's a painfully uncomfortable moment in this movie where Curtis, who had worked at Charlie Trotter's, goes in to eat, or attempts to go in to eat, I should say, right, late in the restaurant's, it's last summer.
Right.
Trotter confronts him. I guess Curtis's name had been on a...
on a lawsuit.
On a class action suit. Yeah. And he's walking into dinner. Graham Elliott Bowles is with him, and yeah, and Curtis is wearing a suit. And Trotter says, you sue anybody lately? And there's this incredibly, I won't get too much into what is said, but it is incredibly uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
It ends with Trotter saying, you better get the fuck out of here.
Right.
And really, I guess conceivably, you know, also Grant Achatz, who is interviewed in this film, who Curtis also worked for. But, you know, when people talk about, especially male chefs, the sort of their mentors, it's very often they talk about, oh, he kicked my ass.
Right.
You know, this is what,
well,
you hear.
You know, there is really only two ways to lead. You know, you nurture them and you bring them along with you, and or you, like, in other words, you don't usually shift. You treat everybody differently, but is moving the team forward. You know, like, I'll use like a sports analogy, like Bill Parcells joins the Giants. So listen, you're going to hate me. I couldn't care less, because in a year and a half when we get the ring, you're going to hug and kiss me. But until then, you're not going to have one nice thing to say about me, and I'll make sure of it, you know. Where, you know, Ruth and, you know, other people, other coaches, other ways to do it are a little bit more with the honey and with the nurturing.
Wasn't Gabe saying that last week or 2 weeks ago on your show, talking about
Gabe McMackin?
Yeah,
that's
Finch,
a very different thing. Yeah.
We've all had somebody in our life that brought us along in a kind and nurturing way, or hopefully we've all had. I certainly have. And then we've all had somebody inspire us with, you know, fear and intimidation and this, you know, it's just not good enough. And until it is, I'm not going to speak to you in any other way besides this wildly harsh and you know, demanding, judgmental way.
Yeah. Something else we see.
And, you know, I mean, if you're going to sue your boss, you might not be welcome in
well,
the restaurant.
Well, you shouldn't go to dinner there.
No, but in the movie, well, we have to point out, in the movie, he does say he has no recollection of signing on to this
yeah,
suit.
But
he has no recollection.
No,
of
there
it?
Was a class action suit. Right. Okay. It was a class action
but
suit.
Let me round that out for you. I was in the same exact position. I took a job once. I shook somebody's hand, and my deal was we won't pay you overtime. Sure, fine. I left the job. Several years later, I get a check in the mail. I don't remember ever signing a piece of paper saying that I'm joining a class action lawsuit. I get a check in the mail.
But there was a class action suit.
It had to be. But again, this was, you know, 15, 20. This was more than 20 years ago. So, you know, basically, I took the check. I put it in an envelope. I mailed it to my boss. And I said, listen, I made the deal with you. I'm going to stick to the deal I made. Here's the money back.
Wow.
And it was more than 10, less than 20 grand. I needed it. I was a cook. You know, no cook has any
right.
money. I had dreams. I wanted to go to Europe. I wanted to hang out. I wanted to be in New York. I wanted to work for, you know, my heroes. But at the end of the day, you know, we're only as good as the word we have. And, like, just as we're only as good as the last thing we made. And, like, I shook on a deal, and I wasn't going to you know, negate that deal just for some money in my pocket that I didn't expect to have coming to me.
Okay.
That's it.
Fair enough. Let's talk about, you know, something else we see in this film is in For Grace is the coming together of a new restaurant. We should say it's a very expensive restaurant. They spend, you know, it's funny. We were talking about our friend Harold Dieterle. You know, years ago, I wrote that when Top Chef debuted and the prize was $100,000 of money to open a restaurant. And I wrote, I was doing a piece on Harold, and I wrote that, you know, all of us who are around the business, at least in New York, thought that was hilarious because you can maybe buy your tables and chairs for that much money.
Maybe.
Maybe. And in this movie, we find out they spent $900,000.
No, 90 grand on chairs.
I'm sorry, 90 grand on chairs.
$2.5 million.
So that gives a sense of the expense of this restaurant, which they basically built from scratch. You see the space, the raw space they start with.
Right. That's the point I would make. You know, if you want to bring something in less expensively, you have to buy an existing space and then turn it into your own space. If you're going to build from raw, you're going to spend millions of dollars. If you're going to change something, not change the usage, but change the look and the feel, you have an opportunity to spend less money. So, but hey, listen, you know, their goal was the best restaurant in Chicago, the best restaurant in America. They couldn't have adapted somebody else's space. They couldn't have gone into a space and changed it enough to make it unique enough to make that statement and to run forward with it.
Yeah. And I think it's really fascinating to watch the thoughtfulness with which they make decisions as they go along.
It's beautiful.
You know, when there's a moment where they're talking about those chairs and the support for the table, and if you're sitting, you know, and another character I love, Michael Musser, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Curtis's partner in the restaurant, they'd worked at the restaurant Avenues together before this, you know, saying, do your feet touch the base of the table? If so, it's a fail.
Right.
Right?
And they were really critical of themselves. If it's not this, then we fail.
Yeah, and if you're walking and they're standing at one point in basically a black box of a space almost, if you're walking from here to here, you have these awkward two steps. I mean, they're really, it really does give you sort of a look into the kind of mindset. And again, you talk about dedication. It's not just about being in a functioning restaurant, you know, for the hours that one puts in, but it's also about building that restaurant, designing it,
and sharing it with somebody else, sharing the process with someone else. It's, you know, it's how I feel about working with you as a collaborator. Watching those two was just hugely exciting to me, because you're never going to agree on everything and you're never going to get along about everything, but at the end of the day, the way they operated together and what they brought forth is magical to me.
Speaking of collaborators, I don't know if you saw Joy Manning's piece in Eater, I think it went up yesterday, about Steve Cook and Michael Solomonov, sort of about the silent collaborators and the credit that they really haven't gotten. And I thought that was just a great story, and really shines a light on a part of the business that doesn't get, I mean, the chef is always the one in the limelight. What about the guy who's making or woman like Ellen Yin at High Street on Market?
Sure.
Who's making
Ron Howard in Glazer, you know, everybody says it's a Ron Howard film.
Brian Glazer. Exactly. Yes.
But I mean, it is, I mean, there are also these partnerships, today, you know, where the partner is very visible, you know, like Nick Kokonis and Grant, or Joe Bastianich and Mario.
True.
Which I've always thought was, you know, a real good safeguard against a lot of the things that have caused some of the professional divorces.
Yeah, you avoid the rift.
That have happened years ago is by both people being in the limelight and each person sort of kind of getting what they need on that front. I think it oftentimes can help shore up against resentments that can develop. I think it depends on the people. But, you know, Jimmy, we talked about this idea. Both of these films really show, and, you know, we are talking about chefs who, in their own ways, they're different generations, Perrier and Duffy. They're different nationalities, although both operated in the U.S.
They're cut from the same cloth.
They have a lot in common. And there is a scene. We talked about the birthday card scene last week from King George. But, you know, there's a Thanksgiving scene shortly before Grace opens. There's a Thanksgiving scene in this movie. And it really, to me, again, I think one of the things this film shows and focuses on more than most other documentaries I've seen is this idea of the kitchen team as a family. You know, what do you call the staff meal at a restaurant? It's family meal.
Yeah.
And they have this Thanksgiving dinner, and most of the people in attendance at the dinner are people from the team of this not even yet opened restaurant. And it did hit me that a lot of people I know who have owned restaurants, and maybe more so in the past because so many places are open on Thanksgiving now, but there's places even that aren't open on Thanksgiving still where they keep the doors locked and they do a Thanksgiving dinner for the team, for the family. They do, you know, what you would call an orphan's Thanksgiving or a, what did you call it before we were talking?
Expat.
An expat Thanksgiving. But did this ring true to you, this notion? It really struck me, you know, the way that it captured what the team comes to mean for people who work in kitchens. I thought that was something that Four Grace did a really good job of putting its finger on and illustrating through a couple of really almost side throwaway scenes, but they stay with you.
Yeah, and it might be a little broader than just the kitchen because ultimately, you know, we're all on the same team. We work for the same
restaurant.
You mean
front of house as well.
Whether it's front of the house or back of the house. But really, you know, hey, listen, it's a team sport, right? And we're only great when the team is great, right? And we do everything together. And when that happens, you have this camaraderie, you know, whether it's live stage in theater, actors or professional athletes. You know, these are all people that sacrifice their holidays and their birthdays, you know, doctors and nurses. They're all team things. And what it is in the restaurant business is you work with these people and you know, for lack of a better way to say it, you do battle with them every day and you become close with them, and you know they're part of your triumphs, they're part of your tribulations, you know, they're with you in the good and the bad, and it's a real genuine thing that, you know, a personal achievement is one thing, a personal achievement in a team sport is another thing, and you really don't know about it till you get involved in it, but it's just a feeling in a way that kind of takes over, and you know, it's a good feeling in a great way, you know, to share and to have people around you, and it can be very supportive, and in this case, you know, listen, if you can't be around on a holiday and you know, enjoy the holiday and want to share it with people, it's really warm and touching to see how they did it. You know, restaurant wasn't even open, yet they made restaurant. They didn't, you know, fake it and make home food. They made the food they wanted to make in the restaurant, but for Thanksgiving. That to me was one of the cooler things about it because everybody was so on board with the momentum and the idea that they wanted to bring forward. There's really no replacing that feeling, and it's very hard to describe that type of feeling when you get like-minded people together and you get the bus or the locomotive going at a certain speed. You know, it's remarkable what a group of dedicated people can do together.
It is, and you see what it means to them. I mean, there's more than one occasion in this movie where you see people brought to tears.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I've been brought to tears by my staff many times. It's again, when you share with people on that. Listen, when you're trying to work on a high level and you're trying to share on a high level, it's exhausting. It's frustrating. But, you know, again, the triumphs that you have in a team sport, you know, are just so remarkable that a lot of times, you know, words fail you and, you know, your emotions are right. What's right behind your words is your emotions, and they come right out.
Well, you know, to that point about words failing you is just a side thing, I guess. But, you know, there is a moment where in For Grace where Curtis reads this letter that his father, who, and it's really tragic. I mean, the guy obviously had emotional problems and went off some medication in the improper way and ended up taking his mom, abducting the mom and then killing his mom and then himself. And he reads to the camera this letter that his father had left behind. And there really was, and it reminded me of, I can't say who it was, but years ago I was working on something and there was a chef who I barely knew who gave me incredible amounts of time, just incredible amounts of time. And at one point I said to him, I didn't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, you know, but like, why are you giving me all this time? And he would never have used the word therapy. But what I realized was that I was functioning almost like a therapist. And I really had this feeling, and I don't know Curtis, and I don't know if he partakes of some kind of therapy or ever did. But there really is this unbelievable intimacy, almost the tone of a confessional, that that Helenowski and Pang, the people who made this movie, who must have just had incredible trust with him. But there are moments, like the reading of that letter probably would be the most extreme one, where you really do feel like somebody is absolutely, you know, bearing their soul to you in a way that I found really stunning. I mean, I really did.
Just, you know, to share on that level, again, it's remarkable. Unfortunately, I know that moment, and I call that moment the why me moment, you know. And for me, it told the story in a certain way where he used the why me moment as, you know, not immediately after grief and the process, but he used it to take large, dedicated steps forward. And, you know, I don't know what the stats are on the why me moment, but you really have two choices, you know. You sit still or you go backwards, and or you just go forward, pick up the pieces and try to make something out of it. You know, again, we were talking about adversity and breeding things in people that are remarkable. You know, some of the most remarkable people have some of the most adverse or tragic stories or backgrounds.
Sure.
Not exclusively, obviously. There's no magic bullet in the conversation. But, you know, what he did with the why me moment, choosing to walk it forward and the way he walked it forward was it's a really good story, and you know the final part of it, where he is now, it's hugely impressive.
It is, and we haven't even touched on the fact that in the middle of all this, and I think one of the few people who's not interviewed is his ex-wife, but there is a divorce. You know, he doesn't see his children.
Guy lost his family twice.
Yeah, well said. So you do see the very, and again, it really does relate to the. King George, to the Perrier story, in terms of these are guys who really...
Oh, yeah, when he got the James Beard Award, what did he do?
Right.
Went up on stage and said he's sorry to his daughter for never being home.
For never being home for her whole life.
The amount of sacrifice in the restaurant industry is unfathomable, I think.
Commitment equals sacrifice, the higher the commitment, the more the sacrifices, you know. But again, restaurant business, to me, it's a team sport kind of thing too, you know. Like we were saying, sports, live theater, you know, live theater always goes on. They're working all the time, and they're only as good as the people around them. And you know, like, this is a cook show or a chef show, but like we're only as good as the dish staff, and the live stage people are only as good as the riggers. You learn to share with people on such a level, and it's such a diverse group of people. It's wildly remarkable.
Yeah. Well, I guess we would really recommend both of these films to people. They're
totally.
Both very short. I'm King George, about an hour and 15 minutes. For Grace, about an hour and a half. Both readily available in various video on demand platforms. And with that, we're going to wrap up today's show. Andrea Strong, thank you for coming in.
It was my pleasure.
I'm scandalized that you've never been to the Heritage Radio Network before.
Well, thank you for ending that horrible legacy of me never being here. Now, of course, I'll be invited back many times.
You're going to have your own show soon.
Right.
Jimmy and I are taking next week off, and then on the 24th, we're going to have a show we mentioned some time ago. Aaron Fairbanks, the executive director of Heritage Radio Network, is going to come in and kind of take over the pilot seat. We'll be here participating, but we're going to have a conversation about a number of issues regarding women in the kitchen, in the pro kitchen, that have been swirling around for the last few years, but a few things that have peaked recently. The incredible gender imbalance in the short list of Beard finalists for the James Beard Awards, the maternity leave.
Yeah, I wrote about
that
this summer,
which
has been open for business.
Yeah,
it's an issue that's keeping women from leading at the rate that they should be leading because they don't have any support.
So we're going to take this on. Jimmy and I will be the only two guys here, but we're not going to run that show. We're going to turn that over to Aaron, which we thought was the appropriate way to go about that. That'll be on the 24th. If you'd like to follow us, you can follow the show on Twitter at Chef Podcast. We're also on Facebook. The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is our page. Please like us there to keep track of what we're doing. And with that, we will see you back in 2 weeks on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
Thanks for listening.
for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.